Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello, I'm David Kern.
I'm Heidi White.
And I'm Tim McIntosh.
And you are listening to Close Reads, a podcast for the incurable reader, on which we are discussing Cormac McCarthy's All the Pretty Horses. And we are now at the end of All the Pretty Horses. This is the...
It's sad.
I know.
It's very sad. Is sad.
So I was wondering, how do you think the audience would feel if we just turned Close Reads into an All the Pretty Horses podcast? All the Pretty Horses, or all the time.
All the Pretty Horses all the time.
Yeah.
That's what we should name our new spinoff podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
We'd have like three listeners. They would love it.
A-T-P-H-A-T-T.
Mm. At footstep.
That is going to get legs.
Yeah, definitely.
It's going to get legs.
Definitely.
Hashtag.
So, yeah, we're here to discuss the end of
the TikTok. End of the book.
And then Tim, the whole show, Heidi and I should have a conversation, and Tim just
and I'm just naming
in the back.
I'm naming social media platforms.
Just like words related to social media. Check mark. So
Facebook.
So we're here to discuss the end. And then next week, of course, we will answer your questions. So I'm sure you have plenty of questions. I've been getting some from email already. If you want to submit questions, you can submit them on the Facebook page, of course. But if you are one of those people who is not on Facebook, then you can email them to me. And it's david@goldberrybooks.com. So we will dive into all of your questions and thoughts next week. To this week, we're going to probably have to talk some more about why this is a hard book for Tim, why I love this book, where Heidi stands after another reading of it, all those sorts of things. Before we get into the show, though, I feel like we should do a little, like, what else is going on in our podcasting world at the beginning of the show? Because normally we do that at the end. And this week, I just thought we'd break tradition because there was a special episode of The Play's the Thing very recently. I think it went up the end of last week.
Yeah.
Tim, what is this very special episode of The Play's the Thing?
It is, let me give you the background for why I wanted to do it. I think my brother and sister are two of the funniest people in the world. Unfortunately, they lack exposure. A lot of people don't know just how funny they are. So I was like, you know what?
You just
platform
them.
We've got like
them.
This little break between the time that the Hamlet podcasts are released. I just need to figure out how to get Carissa and Scott on the air, and maybe I can get my mom on the air. And around about that time, I was snooping around in my mom's office, and I found these old classic comic books that our family used to read when we were kids. And one of them was Hamlet, and one of them was Romeo and Juliet. So I got a PDF of Hamlet made, and I sent it to my brother and sister by email, and I said, don't open this until we're on the show. I'm going to turn the mics on for you guys, and we're just going to go down memory lane. So that's what the podcast was. It was just an attempt to kind of get Carissa and Scott and my mom in the air. And we were recording it, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is so much fun. It's so fun. And no one is going to listen to this thing because it's just us, like, trumping up family jokes from 25 years ago. But apparently people enjoy it.
But it's out there in the world, and you can listen to it wherever you get podcasts by subscribing and checking into that feed for The Play's the Thing.
Thank you, David.
And then after that, we've got Hamlet, right?
Hamlet, I think, should be dropping any day now, maybe tomorrow.
We're recording on Thursday. This episode will go up on Friday. So by the time people have access to this episode on All the Pretty Horses, they should have access to the Hamlet Act 1 episode. So,
beautiful.
Heidi, what's going on in your world
yes,
right
David.
Now?
Yes, David. Well,
yes, we, David.
Yes. In my world, Lucy and I are planting carrots today. We harvested some zucchini and some basil. And what else is going on? Also, we have the conference, the Circe National Conference, coming up next week with great excitement and preparation. I am sure all of our people around the world are already planning their outfits, which is a big deal when you go to the Circe National Conference. And I have been working on that. I've been working on my talks for that, recording the daily poem, recording the plays, The Thing, talking a lot about Hamlet lately. Yep. Thinking about the meaning of life, and so then I'm reading this little book called All the Pretty Horses by this guy named Cormac McCarthy.
Yeah. At the risk and of ruining your
wondering about the meaning of life. So go on.
At the risk of ruining that excellent segue, I'm reading a book called All the Pretty Horses. Like, that's a great opportunity.
That for was almost David like Heidi was saying, let's get on with it.
Right. I'm going to interrupt us even further. Heidi, how finalized are your wardrobe decisions for the conference? Are you
halfway there? I would say about halfway there. my question as a follow-up is, I mean, do guys think about this? This is a real question. Like, do guys think about what they're going to wear to something or not really?
David?
Yeah.
I just came back from going to the dry cleaners.
Right. Did you really?
Yes.
I have to get stuff like twice a year. I got to go to the dry cleaner right before the conference and right before somebody I know is getting married. And actually both of those things are happening in the next 10 days. So
it's very exciting.
2 weeks. Yeah. So
it's a good time of year. One of my favorite, I will say the national conference doesn't feel a little bit like Christmas. But I don't have to cook. I just get to go out and eat all the good food that Charleston has to offer.
You get to drink the wine, eat the cheese and read the book.
That's exactly right.
Yes.
Yeah. Nicely we should done. Have a close reads holiday and everybody has to do that as a tradition.
What would be the date of said holiday?
That's a great question.
I mean, it would need to kind of correspond with something bookish, with an author's birthday or maybe an author's death.
How about tomorrow?
I love this idea.
Is something going
we're
on
not
tomorrow?
All together.
Well, I mean, how hard would that be?
Is it Ayn Rand's birthday tomorrow?
Yeah,
is
that tomorrow?
What are you saying right now? You're fired.
Wendell Berry's birthday is, I think, in August or September. We could do him. We could do
that. Would be a good
Tolstoy, one. Tolkien. We'll have to think on this. We'll have to think on the official close reads holiday / festival / reason to get everyone together.
The high and holy listeners. Holiday of the exactly. close reads tradition.
Well, before we get too into the weeds of planning a holiday and making it, you know, a convincing lobbying for it to become a public banking holiday, we should probably discuss All the Pretty Horses.
As I just said, have so many ideas right now about cheese and wine and books.
Heidi, you're just going to have to hold on. We'll talk about it, okay?
All right.
We'll talk
sounds
about it.
Good.
Don't worry.
All right. Dot, dot, dot.
There will be a time for it. It's like when you're texting somebody and those little gray dot, dot, dots are coming up because you know
there will
that
be time.
They're thinking. And then the next day there they text you and say, oh, sorry, just saw this.
You're like, you liar. You've already saw
I already saw your dots. Okay.
I
so
I think Heidi going into, I promise I'll let you start, David, in a second. I think going into this final chapter, these final
chapters. The listeners
chapters
are so annoying.
I know. Of All the Pretty Horses, we shouldn't be thinking about wine and cheese. We should be thinking about hardtack and swill. That's kind of what faces us for the last
I am banning hardtack and swill from
even
the
for the last
holiday.
The last, I think to get in the spirit of the conclusion of All the Pretty Horses, it has to be hardtack and swill.
This is why I never wanted to read Cormac McCarthy right now.
We just clarified.
I'm not even ever having swill.
We just clarified for her why she's always resisted for so long.
That's
but here
right.
we are at the end.
She is now,
despite her fears of the swill, she has read it and she has listened to it. Tim, this makes how many times for you?
I think
eight.
Do you
even know? Okay.
And so
and I kind of am ready to start on number 9 probably next week.
I think this is 4. For me, I don't remember what I said at the beginning, but I was counting and I think it's 4. I may have forgotten one somewhere along the line. It's a pretty good book. Pretty good book.
Pretty good book.
It's awesome. It's an awesome book.
There's I was thinking about how to start this conversation as I do. You know, I jot down a few notes, write down a few questions, mark up my book as I'm reading with a pencil, try to identify a spot that can get us into it. And then I didn't know where to begin because, again, we get the book is a different book here. We could talk about how I think there's no other way that this book could possibly have ended. We could talk about how the final sentence harkens back to the very first sentence of the book. Structurally, thematically, metaphorically, we could talk about poor John Grady and his leg. We could talk about his departure from Rollins. We could talk about the way Cormac McCarthy deals with justice in this section and the conversation with the judge. We could talk about all kinds of questions. So what I'm wondering is, Tim, mm-hmm. having read this for the 12th time, I assume mm-hmm. you've read it three times since I last asked you. Mm-hmm. Having read it this ninth time, what most stands out to you about why you think you love this book? This is kind of a how self-aware are you question. And personally, I'm fascinated with the idea of being like a self-aware reader and like the way books say a lot about ourselves and how our tastes change because of that and those sorts of things. So having read it for all these years, why does this book stay with you? Why do you keep going back to it? Nine times is a lot. You could have read eight other books, but you come back to this book over and over again. And I'd love to know if you have any more of a sense of why that is, having read it this time. You probably mm-hmm. had a reasons for it the fifth time, the seventh time, and so forth. But has that come into more focus for you? Do you think you've discovered new things about yourself or about the book that have helped you think about the book in a different way?
I don't know if it's a discovery that I made during this read, but a recent read, I kind of came to the conclusion that I think the number one reason that I love this book is that I always feel like it's telling the truth. Always, always, always telling the truth. And mixed up in that is this very, I don't know what the right word is, but this very spiritual, this very metaphysical, this very poetic vision of the meaning of life and nature and kind of like this masculine journey into the world. And so subsets of that, I love the relationship between Rollins and John Grady Cole. I love the relationship between Alejandra and John Grady Cole. I love the relationship between John Grady Cole and the horses that he breaks, tames, rides, salvages. You know, so that's a big list. Maybe I should just stop. That's a big list.
All the pretty horses always tells the truth.
I honestly, that's the number one reason. I just trust Cormac McCarthy so fully. I think if it made it into the book, it is the way that it was. And maybe it's a strange thing to say about a book that's fiction, but I'm sure that you guys have had these moments where we talked about it on the air, where an author is grinding their own axe. They want you to believe something about the world and they lie to you in order to do it. I think I used the example of James Duncan, the writer of
The River Wye.
River Wye and Brothers yeah. K. I just feel like he lied to me. And
poor guy's taking a beating from you on this podcast. That's not even anybody's book.
Part of the reason why I'm not afraid to name his name is because that's such a, to me, like it's this sacred task. Writing fiction is a sacred task. And it's hard to write fiction. It's hard to keep someone's attention for that long. It's hard to, you know, to weave a spell that's so powerful that people forget they're writing a book and they imaginatively enter this alternate world. Mm-hmm. And when someone violates that trust, for me, that's a really serious violation. And you may not agree with Cormac McCarthy's vision of the world, but I would press anybody to find a place where he's lying to you. You know what I mean?
What would he be lying? You mean about how the world works, how the world was for the, in this period? What is he telling the truth about? What would he be lying about?
Okay. I'll use a simple example.
If I did jump in at any time.
In this section, John Gertie Cole rides back into town, and there are these two men that are working on the engine of a truck, of a car. And if he described the car, and that car did not exist for 10 years after the moment that we see in the story, right? Let's just imagine that. That's just a failure of research. Cormac McCarthy didn't do his work well enough to realize that this is a model that didn't exist during the time that John Gertie Cole reenters the town, right? That's kind of forgivable. That's just, I would just say our author was lazy. He didn't do enough research.
Or he's just using it for creative purposes. And
yeah, but I think there would be, if he's using it for creative purposes, I would think we could kind of see, hopefully, the purpose behind it. And you could kind of, tolerable.
Yeah.
But I think since we're joking about Ayn Rand, part of the reason that all of the three of us have such a profound dislike for Ayn Rand is that her books are like thick lies that encase like germs of genuine insight and truth. Like, I think her vision of like the responsibility of individual human beings for their own lives, I think that's a profound insight and one that like, I really want to live my life that way. Too bad that insight is surrounded by 682 pages of
drivel.
Of like, that's a nice way of saying it. A really nice way of saying it. So the example that I gave of Cormac McCarthy, like a research error is, I think he doesn't make those, but also I just think that his insight into the psychology of his characters, to the way that people operate actually in the world. I just find that
there's a consistency.
It's consistent, and it's consistent also to like the experience that I have of male and female psychology. I know that his focus is especially on male psychology. So it's a little bit easier for me to kind of register because I share that male psychology. I think he's a master at that. Heidi, is this a motivating factor for why you came to like Cormac McCarthy? Do you have other reasons why?
Because, and I was going to ask a variation on the same question to you after a second reading, first time reading and plus a listen, I would love to know how your opinion on the book has changed and evolved and what it means to you and see how it differs from a person who's read it 9 times.
Right. I really love what you just said, Tim, a lot. And I think I love it for the same reason, just inverted. Let me explain that. It is a very masculine story. And so I love it because I feel like if I was a man, I would love it because it kind of would like take me more into myself, but because I'm a woman, I love it because it kind of takes me out of myself and makes me look at the world in a different way and understand the world in a different way, which I think is the same thing you just said, just inverted, about him telling the truth all the time.
Yeah.
Because it is one of those stories, like in the first podcast, we talked about how this particular novel has almost like a mythological or primeval quality to it. And that's the reason why myths are so powerful, is because they tell the truth about being human, even though on the surface or on the literal level of the story, it's something that might never happen, right? And I've actually been thinking a lot about this, because this idea of what you just said about being a self-aware reader is, as I've been preparing my talks for the National Conference, both of my talks are about kind of entering into a mythological story and finding it as a mirror to your own soul, and then using it as kind of like a map to navigate the world, which is something David Hicks says in Norms and Nobility. That's the purpose of mythos. That's the purpose of the imaginative cultural experience. We create myths as a culture, and then those myths then become a map for the people of within the culture, kind of use the values and the ideals that are embedded within the mythology as maps for how to navigate the world. And so that's why somebody like C.S. Lewis says that, or Tolkien says that myths tell a truer story, right? That's what we mean by that. Because on the literal level, it doesn't happen that way. There's not gods and goddesses wandering around the earth and intervening in the lives of men, at least that we can see. Maybe there are. And I think that Cormac McCarthy has earned, then, as you've said, Tim, he kind of goes that way within his novels. They're not myths, they're novels, but they do have this kind of mythological primeval truth to them, this quality to them, this psychological consistency, as you said, and this enduring, the characters kind of go through this recognizable and enduring story of the development of the soul throughout the novels. So as I read it this time, I experienced that. You know, John Grady Cole he's three things, right? He's more than a man because he can do things that regular men can't do. He's his own man. He's a specific character with his own individuality, his own story. And then in a sense, he's kind of like an everyman, right? Like the everyman is kind of on this journey that he's on. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to write a character like that. Really hard. And he succeeds, McCarthy succeeds. And because of that, then we can all recognize our own humanity in his journey, and we can kind of submit to that and learn from it.
So this brings up a question that I thought about a lot as coming to the end of this reading. How is JGC, how is John Grady Cole different at the end of the book than he was at the beginning? How has he changed?
I think he's heartbroken.
After going through everything that he's gone through.
I think Alejandra, I don't know that Alejandra broke his heart as much as the world that she inhabited broke his heart. Thou shalt not enter here, you know, is kind of what that world said. I actually think he's wiser in a way that he probably wished that he wasn't wiser, but I think he knows a lot more mm-hmm. about how the world operates. I think it's a lot bloodier than he thought it was. I don't think of him as a particularly naive character at the beginning of the book, but he's young. He's a young man. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he could probably have heard 100 cowboy stories of, you know, slaughter yeah. and bloodshed.
It's not abstract
and
anymore.
Bulls goring men in the stomach. But it's different when you see it. It's different when you're like taking the knife yourself.
Heidi, what do you think? Tim says he's heartbroken.
Question.
He's wiser.
I think that's true. I think that he, oh man. I mean, those two words kind of cover it for me. He is heartbroken. And one thing that I love about JGC is he's just such a quintessential American, right? He goes into this culture with this, not naivete, as you said, but this set of assumptions that are very American, meaning I'm going to go on my own, like this, or with a buddy that I trust, and I'm going to encounter the world on the terms that I have accepted. And then when he finds that those terms are no longer sufficient, he changes his strategy, right? And then when he discovers like a wall, like there's no actual strategy that is going to overcome this particular obstacle in my path. I'm not going to get the girl. I'm not going to get the ranch. And I've lost my best friend and I'm heartbroken and wounded. And like, I'm going to get that horse. That's what I'm going to do. Right. Like, and then he responds and still as this like very American man, then he just kind of goes off into the world as a lone cowboy. So I think in many ways, even in his wisdom and his heartbreak, he ends in a lot of ways as he has begun. And, but knowing himself for the first time, to use a different, you know, to use a reference to T.S. Eliot, like he ends at the beginning, but knows himself for the first time. And that's a worthwhile place to be. Like that's a worthwhile journey. But it's a lonely one, right? So we are left then with our own reaction to his solitary presence in a harsh world.
So would you say that self-aware, he's more self-aware? Is that what you're saying? Is that one of the things you would?
I think he is, but he's not like self-aware in the very contemporary sense that we would, you know, go to counseling and learn a bunch of jargon and say that, put a label on ourselves and
you know what I mean?
Like that. So, but I think that he's self-aware in the sense that he's fully inhabiting the moment that he's in and has gained something for the future. Maybe that's even a better way to know yourself than to go sit in an office and put a bunch of labels on yourself. I don't know.
So as you have been, the two of you have been talking, I've just been writing down words that came to mind that I think kind of summarize ways that he is different. So John Grady Cole, the end of the book, is now heartbroken, Tim says, wiser. I put self-aware down and we can use that just because it's a loose category. Heidi, you mentioned that he had ridden off with a friend. Along the way, he meets another friend. He also meets someone who he falls in love with. At the beginning, he has a father. And at the end, all those people are gone and he's solitary. So he's alone at the end. He's definitely wounded. That was a word that came to mind, physically and otherwise. Mm-hmm. But he's also proven. He's proven himself. I think he's proven what he's capable of to himself. That's one of the things you said made me think of that. So that's six things that the two of you were saying speaking of labels, those are the labels on those groups of things that I just put down. The reason I ask this question is because
why he leaves Texas.
I think the important things to ask at the end is why John Grady Cole leaves. I think, and I'm fascinated by, why he leaves. He doesn't go back to home and try to make a start there and hang out with his friend. His best friend is there, right? I know he doesn't have the ranch and his father's gone, but why does he ride out of town at the end? Why does he, ride off into the sunset? I mean, he literally rides off into the sunset. And so we can talk about that as an image, but I think I also want to talk about why he makes that choice. And I think one of the entryways into that is by saying, well, this is a guy who is now, this is how he has changed, that it leads up to this moment when he leaves.
Yes.
And one of the things that the book talks about continuously that we have brought up on the show a bunch is that this is a book about making decisions. Like, if you make this decision, this is going to happen. If you don't make this decision, this could happen or this might not happen. No matter what decision you make, you don't actually know what's going to happen, but something is going to happen because you made that decision. And at the end of the book, he makes another big decision. And that big decision is to ride off into the sunset, to leave his friend behind and to leave the home that he grew up in behind as well. So given what we know of him and how he's changed throughout the story, why do you think John Grady Cole leaves? And before, I want to say one more thing while I let you think, one more rambly thought. It struck me like a brick in the head that I had questions about why he left, like intellectual questions, but to Tim's point about truth, didn't doubt that choice, that creative choice for Cormac McCarthy, right? I said at the beginning, there's no other way this book could have ended dramatically. Like from the creative choice, this is the only option I believe Cormac McCarthy had. He made the right decision. But mm-hmm. so I like it feels, you know, how you just respond emotionally or, you know, just, it just feels right. McCarthy made that decision. But why is it that it feels right? Like, why did he leave at the end? Why does it feel so right? That's the question that I had, because he spent the whole book trying to earn us as a reader feeling like he made the right decision. And how you get there is like fascinating and ridiculous and difficult.
I agree with you.
Unless you just disagree.
How I see like a couple of big events that happen, I think, leading up to the conclusion of the book. They both happen in this section. One of the first pages that we read in this section,
yeah,
Alejandra comes to him. They're in the hotel and she says, I can't be with you. You know, this is the thing in the world that he least wants to hear. Page 254 is his response. He saw very clearly how all of his life led only to this moment, and all after led nowhere at all. He felt something cold and soulless enter him like another being, and he imagined it would smile, and it smiled malignly, and he had no reason to believe it would ever leave. Now, fast forward, he goes back to get his horses. He has to take the sheriff hostage, the man who did him wrong as you can be done. You know, he basically trumps up charges against John Grady Cole. He takes him hostage. They ride out into the desert, and the jailer, he's not a sheriff. I can't remember what he exactly is. But they ride out into the captain. That's right. And John Grady Cole, it makes all the sense in the world for John Grady Cole to
call
him
captain,
not just because it would be safer for him to be dead, but also because it would be kind of like a completion of this revenge cycle. Everything in the world says John Grady Cole should kill that man, especially coming on the heels of this something cold and soulless entering him and feeling like it's never going to leave him. But what does John Grady Cole say to him? I'm not like you. I'm not like you. And he makes a decision to let the man go. The Capitan goes, and it comes back at John Grady Cole. Again, if he had just killed the captain, he would not have to worry about it. But the captain is discovered by these men, and we think, oh my goodness, he wakes up, does John Grady Cole to the barrel of a rifle, and you think, oh man, no. He did the right thing, and it's going to go wrong for him again. No, actually, we get a glimmer of justice. These men, it's like we don't get much information about them, just that they are men of the country. And it seems very clear that they know who the Capitan is, and they're there to bring justice to this guy. And not only do they let John Grady Cole go, but they actually equip him for the journey. He gets a serape for the journey. So I think, to me, even though that's not the biggest moment of the book by a long shot, that to me is the clearest indication of John Grady Cole's future. So did he discover himself in Mexico? No, but he was put into a position to make like a life, to make a choice about the sort of man that he wanted to be. And I think he chose, like he made the hardest decision, and it was a good decision.
I agree with that. I think that to what David brought up earlier, if one of the primary preoccupations of the novel is what is justice and how does justice manifest in the world, right? I think in the second half of the novel, we do see that that John Grady Cole's strong moral center is, although very individualized, that it does indeed produce more than just suffering in the world, right? That there is, mm-hmm. I mean, even calling those men of the country is significant, super significant. He draws a lot of attention to it, even within the paragraph on that page, that this country is not just a savage, brutal wasteland of like lost souls. There is an mm-hmm. internal justice. There is a cohesiveness to this culture. It's just not John Grady Cole's culture. And I think one of the questions raised by the novel is I think the primary example of this is JGC and Alejandra. The question is, can these cultures find any common ground? Can they, so to speak, marry each other in some way, right? And the conclusion the novel comes to is no. They're different. There is a barrier between Mexico and the United States, and it can't be crossed, but each of them has its own beauty, its own cohesiveness, its own goodness. It's just specific, you know.
I really want to hear what you guys think about the last two kind of big characters that we meet at the end of the book, the judge and, I hesitate to call him a preacher, the on-air personality, Jimmy Blevins. Yeah. Because you were saying, Heidi, you know, how like mythical this book feels.
It's Jimmy,
you know,
Blevins,
it has such a huge scope. And so for the final two new characters that we meet to be a judge and a preacher, they feel they feel more symbolic than
very, very much
like a re-meeting of you know,
very archetypal
Rollins. Yeah, very archetypal. That's a better way of saying it. Very archetypal.
So one of the things I love about this is I think what he does is he takes these characters and he often ties them to other moments or images that often mm-hmm. can be kind of fleeting. So in this case, right after what you were reading, Tim, on the bottom of 255, there's a part, she's basically just left him. Yeah, she gets on the train, she leaves, and what does he see? It says, when he walked out the door, he didn't know where he was. A fine rain was falling. He tried to take his bearings from La Bufa standing above the city to the west, but he was easily lost in the winding streets, and he asked a woman for the way to the Centro. And she pointed out the street and then watched him as he went. When he reached Hidalgo, a pack of dogs was coming up the street at a high trot. And as they crossed in front of him, one of their number slipped and scrabbled in the wet stones and went down. The others turned in a snarling mass of teeth and fur, but the fallen dog struggled up before he could be set upon, and all went on as before. He walked out to the edge of town along the highway north and put out his thumb. He had almost no money, and he had a long way to go. And then the bottom of 256, he's lying he gets a ride, and then he's lying next to the horse at a horse on a stake rope, and he's lying there at night. And it says, he imagined the pain of the world to be like some formless parasitic being seeking out the warmth of human souls wherein to incubate. And he thought he knew what made one liable to its visitations. I'm fascinated, side note, by the form of that sentence. We could talk about that another time. I might have to write an essay on that one sentence. What he had not known was that it was mindless, and so had no way to know the limits of those souls. And what he feared was that there might be no limits. And then there's a scene a little bit later. Most of these things happen as he's just kind of wandering home. And he runs across a wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And it's after he's dealt with
David. Before you get into the wedding, what I mean, like I have a picture of what these scenes, how they really like underscore the theme of the book. But how do you see those scenes?
Okay, so I think the wedding thing is important. I'll just mention that there's a wedding scene along the way too. So he sees these dogs, he sees this wedding, and I think that this ties back to the question of the preacher and the judge, because we have a wedding, and that's tied to the preacher, and then there's. I think the judge in some ways is tied to this dog scene. And I'm not saying he's drawing this direct one-to-one correlation, but there's all these things that thematically seem to, like, you know, you could do like a, make a board on your wall and tie like strings, like clues in a investigation or something, and
like
tie
a crazy
how,
person?
Show how these
I'm
different
just
things, like a crazy person. Yeah. You could tie all these things together.
It? What are the, how?
What do you mean by it?
I think he's asking you to draw those, to, uh-huh. to like uh-huh. verbally draw the strings.
Yeah.
Well, I can't do that. No. Okay. So, well, I think we've got judges in this question of justice. So if a judge represents justice or forces us to ask questions of justice and contemplate them in the context of the story, then what is the preacher asking us to contemplate? And I'd love to, how do you guys dive into, like, how did you guys think about that? The judge maybe is more obvious because they have a conversation about justice. The preacher goes and takes a nap, and the wife, I guess, is the one that serves him cobbler, and, you know, they're alone. There had been someone there, and she makes a point to say, you know, we're alone now. But she does this whole diatribe about how great Jimmy Blevins is and how he's trying to serve people, and it wears him out. He has to take naps. So I don't know that that's as obvious, like thematically, what McCarthy's trying to do there as the judge and the questions of justice. How do you read that scene? Like, is there a theme that you do, or an idea that you take from that? Go ahead, Heidi. I think you were going to say something.
The scene with Blevins Sr., I mean, on ostensibly the plot point is to figure out if he is really Jimmy Blevins' dad, but that's left hanging, which is fascinating to me, like totally fascinating to me, because it seems that JGC walks away from that conversation feeling like it doesn't even matter anymore. And that's interesting. There's something quite haunting about that scene. And I was trying to figure out why. And I want to hear the two of your thoughts on it, because I couldn't figure out what was so haunting to me. Maybe it was the juxtaposition of this preacher making a claim that he is solving so many problems of the world over the radio and the laying on of hands and all this, juxtaposed with the depth of suffering explored by the novel, that it takes place without being seen by anybody. And as you said, David, that the idea of like this kind of nameless suffering, this the wounds of the world. I keep thinking there's a poem by a Somali poet, Warsonshire, I think it is, and it one of the sections of the poem is so haunting. It is. And I think I'm getting this word for word or pretty close. Because I opened an atlas and I ran my fingers down the page and I asked the world, where does it hurt? And it answered, everywhere, everywhere, everywhere. And I think that is one of the big explorations of Cormac McCarthy, and maybe one of the reasons, Tim, why you are like so revere his unflinching truth telling, is because there is within Cormac McCarthy's novels this unflinching is the word I can think of, this like ironclad choice to gaze at the suffering of the world always, mm-hmm. right? And to take it into account. Mm-hmm. And to hold it up for us to just look at, right? Like imagine him like taking this like nameless suffering and just like, look at this to us as readers, right? And I think that's profoundly brave. And so that obviously is a trace throughout the novel, directly explored in the novel, even in that section David just read, like this sense of that suffering is just this
parasite.
Yeah. And it doesn't care who it hurts. It's not personal. It's just, there you go. You're going to suffer. And that is terrifying, right? That's the existential void. And that is what Jimmy Blevins Sr. offers to the world is insufficient to that. It is not enough. And yet he's exhausted and overwhelmed by it so much that he has to go to sleep in the middle of a conversation. And I think that does tie in. If you were trying strings on a wall like a crazy person, it actually isn't crazy. It does indeed make a pattern, and it does connect with all of this exploration. And so I think that that's maybe why I found it so haunting, as both times in reading it and listening to it, that conversation just kind of like unsettled me, but I couldn't say why. And maybe that's why.
There's two key themes in those two conversations, which happen back to back right before he gets home. Right. And one, when you hear the conversation with the judge, there's this theme of justice. Right. But the more interesting theme in that section for me is the theme of confession. Because he wants to confess, he wants to be healed.
Yeah.
And so first he goes, he wants to feel as if he can be
He treats him like the priest, right? Like it's him that he treats. Yeah. He confesses to him and wants to be absolved.
He says, why do you think you didn't kill him? And John Grady says, I don't know. And it says, well, said the judge, I guess that's something between you and the good Lord. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you say? Yes, sir. I didn't mean that I expected an answer. Maybe there ain't no answer. It just bothered me that you might think I was something special. I ain't. Well, that ain't a bad way to be bothered. He picks up his hat. It looks like he's about to get up, but he doesn't. The reason I wanted to kill him was because I stood there and let him walk that boy out in the trees and shoot him, and I never said nothing. Would it have done any good? No, sir, but that don't make it right. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, there is a question of justice. Like, but more than that, there's a question of confession, like being cleansed by confession. And the very next scene, you get the theme of healing. And in neither case does he come away from it, I think, feeling truly cleansed or healed.
Healing. I thought you were going to say the very next scene, you meet Jimmy Blevins, the radio.
Yeah, because there's that theme of healing, because people are like, she's talking about how he gets worn out because people are laying their hands on the radio and stuff like that. What would you think I was going to say, though?
Well, I thought you were.
That's why
you were talking about what I was gonna say. What I thought was the next thing was the encounter with Jimmy Blevins.
Yes.
Yeah. To echo your point, David, he begins the conversation, the second conversation with the judge. He comes back to the judge's house, and the judge says, "You know, John Grady Cole says that I don't feel right about what happened in the courtroom." And the judge says, "What way do you feel?" And he said, "I don't feel justified. I don't feel justified." And then he walks through all the reasons that he doesn't feel justified. Justified, legal language, like in the Protestant world, especially salvific language, you know, we've been like brought to the bar and found wanting. So he goes to the judge. I think the judge handles it beautifully. He hears his confession in a way, you know, but it seems like John Grady Cole is still not satisfied. Like maybe he recognizes, okay, I haven't done anything legally wrong. I'm not culpable in that way. But he still feels guilty. He does not feel justified. He does not feel made right. And I can't think, it's disturbing to me, because I'm a Christian, that Jimmy Blevins is given the last voice of possible justification for John Grady Cole. And I kind of wrestle with this, you know, I wrestle with that. I think the biggest buffoon in the entire book is a Protestant Christian radio personality. He's kind of given the last word. And I think that Cormac McCarthy's answer is that what Jimmy Blevins' radio personality has to offer is it cannot help John Grady Cole. Now, what do you do with that? What do you do with that? If that's Cormac McCarthy's.
Well, I was going to say, I think it's super crucial the way the scene with the judge ends, though, because he says, there's nothing wrong with you, son. I think you'll get it sorted out. And he says, yes, sir, I guess I will if I live. And at the very end, it says, he's leaving. It says, he turned the horse and looked at him standing in the door light, and he raised his hand, and the judge raised a hand back, and he rode out down the street from pool to pool of lamplight until he had vanished in the dark. And I think I may be reading too much into it, but I think it's important that he's going from pool to pool of lamplight. Like, I think Cormac McCarthy using that image is, if nothing else, fascinating, because I think in many ways it represents the way McCarthy views a journey through the world itself. From pool, you're going from pool to pool of lamplight, and between the pools there's darkness. And I think
I can see that.
Go ahead, Heidi.
No, I'm just like nodding vigorously because I totally agree with that. I completely, and I think that's one of the reasons why JGC is the ideal McCarthyan hero, because he's so led by his internal moral compass that it helps him navigate right between the pools of light within these pools of darkness. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of the reasons why he ends up alone and why that feels right to us.
Mm-hmm.
That there is this archetypal image of this man, you know, having to navigate the world alone, that's the way it just has to be, because the world is not, you know, the world is not enough for this, you know, kind of solitary hero. And the right culture for that, the solitary hero, is always going to be America. It is this is the place for the individual lone wolf hero who has, you know, the troubled dark side to him and who's been through all of these sad things. Like we want him to be with Alejandro, right? But it would feel wrong. Like if they ended up together, this would not be a great book. There is something about him that kind of begs for the lonely, solitary hero's journey.
I do think it's important to finish the thought about Jimmy Blevins. If there are two ways that a person in the United States at this time in our history, the 1950s, can come to some sense of justification, it's either through like some sort of legal justification or through, I think, what Jimmy Blevins is probably preaching on the air. And within the United States, there's always been these kind of like two streams of thinking about Christianity. One of them is kind of like the big top. It's the Jimmy Blevins way. It's the broad path. And there, I mean, our country, if you've done much reading in American church history, I've done more than I've wanted to. No, that's not true. Not more than I wanted to. I would like to do more. But it becomes very clear that there are these two kind of approaches. One of them is big, wide, shallow. It's Jimmy Blevins. And the other is this smaller stream, either within that or beside that, depending on how you understand it, that finds that to be deeply satisfying, maybe not even like, not even the same religion that Jesus founded, you know, more of like a big top religion or something like that. And I think that Cormac McCarthy is keenly aware of kind of like the history of Christianity in the United States. And I think he closes the door to that being an opportunity to John Grady Cole finding some sense of justification, which I think is what he has not resolved in himself at the end of the book. And I think, David, the picture of traveling through the lamplight, darkness to light, back and forth, I completely agree. I think that's where John Grady Cole is when our book ends. He's on horseback. We don't know where he's going to end up. Oh, but we find out in book three of the Border Trilogy. Tune in next month.
Yeah. On A-T.
On
H-A-T-T.
H-A-T-T.
Hey, okay, but we got to talk about the preacher, because you seem to think, I think you even called him a buffoon. Heidi, do you think, is that how you read him?
It was the first time and not the second time.
Really?
Yeah.
How did you read him?
I read him... I think this is open to interpretation, and you may very well be right. I read him the second time as a sincere, overwhelmed, believing man that had bought into his own hype. But
the difference between that and a buffoon is
It's slim, but I also think that the first time I read him as a fake and a phony. Oh. And the second time I did not. And so I mean, do you think that it's Jimmy Blevins' dad?
No. No, I think, I mean, don't we, I think it's pretty clear that it's not.
No, because they say they make a reference to somebody being missing in the family.
We just eat in the kitchen. Now that there's just two of us, he didn't ask who was missing.
Thank you, David.
So it's possible that that's Jimmy Blevins.
So Tim, you would say he just heard on the radio the name and used that name?
Yeah. Yeah.
I absolutely think that McCarthy left the door open that these are Jimmy Blevins' parents.
It's totally possible. It's totally possible.
And so, but I think it's intentionally ambiguous, right? And so and it makes it maybe a little more interesting if he actually is.
I think you have to go back and read Blevins' words earlier in the book with that in mind to try to suss that out.
I don't know why. I think that the fact that they've never seen the horse and that they don't associate the horse with their son. I mean, granted, Jimmy Blevins Jr., if he is a junior, Jimmy Blevins Jr. could have stolen the horse long after he left his father's home. Absolutely plausible.
Right, because he tells the story about how he went off to work in the bowling alley and that's when he got, you know, right. And so I think that there's that either way, it doesn't fall apart if they don't recognize the horse. But I think it's ambiguous purposefully. And I, you know, that sentence that David read was so intentional that it had to be McCarthy leaving the door open. And the fact that JGC doesn't follow up, which is in that perfectly written sentence, right? That's when it says John Grady Cole did not ask who was missing, that he's decided it doesn't even matter anymore. Something in that interaction has led him to, this isn't about the horse. I don't even think I want to know.
I would say now it comes down to like a question of John Grady Cole's character. Mm-hmm. Like if it possibly is, I don't know. Maybe I'm just like trying to justify my own position. I just need to be justified.
I don't think you're supposed to know.
I just think John Grady Cole would press into that a little bit. Maybe I'm wrong.
It says he doesn't though. It straight up says he does not ask.
Meaning if he thought that there was reason to believe this was their son, he would have pressed into it. I think he did not believe it was a possibility, but I don't know.
It's a minor point.
To me, the funny thing is I would read it more like once he realizes who they are, he doesn't want to put them through.
Yes.
He doesn't ask because he doesn't want to have to explain what happened to them.
That's funny. And I would think John Grady Cole would want to be able, I mean, like if you have the option of having a child, of never knowing what happened to your child and hearing your child is dead, I think John Grady Cole would know. They're both horribly painful. I'd rather deal with the pain from like knowledge of what actually happened.
So again, it's ambiguous. Totally. Yeah. It's left open to the reader and you can make a case from either side.
This is Hemingway's negation thing.
Exactly. Yes. It's left blank there. Well, and that, what you just said, Tim, reminded me obliquely, it's a little bit tangential, but of the conversation with the judge, which I think reminded me so much of, as David said, it was so confessional in nature. And also it kind of tugged on my heartstrings a little for this like fatherless boy looking for a father figure to tell him like in the absence of his father, he needs a man to tell him he did right. You know, and I also the way that the judge responded to him must have been so healing to him. I was really glad for this is why he's not a nihilist, right? I'm really thankful for those threads of grace that go through the book that he honors him and also and takes into account John. He sees John Grady Cole's strong morality, right? His moral mm-hmm. center. He sees it and he's moved by it. Mm-hmm. The judges.
And rewards it even.
Rewards it. And yeah, exactly. Affirms him. And I think that kind of blessing, that not only the absolution of the sins, so to speak, but also the blessing, is kind of a fortifying moment for John Grady Cole as he sets out on his new journey as, you know, in the solitary American hero.
Yeah.
Whatever happens to him next, he was, somebody heard him, somebody heard his confession, somebody absolved him, and someone set him free to move on with that kind of resolution on his life.
The judge is almost Solomonic in a way. I mean, the way that he determines, kind of like gives proof case for John Grady Cole's story. He has like these two proofs. He asks, what is the name of that hacendado, yeah. I think?
Mm-hmm. Or how many hectares?
Yep.
How many hectares
yeah.
are? And then the other thing that he asked for is like...
drop your drawers.
Yeah. He asked to see the gunshot wound. Yeah. Like a really clever way of kind of confirming. Yeah. This story, this crazy story that you just told, there's a couple of proofs, one of memory and one of physical evidence.
So this preacher though, I want to come see if we can come to some resolution on it. And so you think there's a buffoon, and then Heidi said a fine line between a buffoon and so an earnest, someone who's genuine. How do we read? Go ahead, Tim.
If he's Jimmy Blevins Sr., and if his boy is the one who we meet along the way, and this is a heartbroken character, Jimmy Blevins Sr., the radio personality, is a heartbroken character, boy, I have so much more sympathy for him, and I would be really reluctant to call him a buffoon. He's a heartbroken man if that's the case. And I can have all the sympathy in the world for him. Since I don't read him that way, it's hard for me to see him as anything other than kind of someone who's reading his own headlines, you know?
Yeah.
But even then, so I, even in that case, even if Jimmy Blevins was Jimmy Blevins, the boy was his son, we have mm-hmm. to hold him culpable in some ways for Jimmy Blevins. I find him less sympathetic if he's just Jimmy Blevins' real father, because he has wounded his son so much, driven him out, and he doesn't even, and now all he can talk about is his ministry and all the good he's doing in the world and blah, blah, blah. So it's really interesting. This is one of this is one of those parts of a novel that brings out different reactions in different readers, which is mm-hmm. goes to the power of leaving something open-ended within a story, right? Because I find him way more sympathetic if he's not Jimmy Blevins' father, if he's just like this childless man trying to like do the right thing, and but he's bought into his own hype. And so anyway, that I think it's pretty clear he's not rich. So he's just a middle-class guy.
Oh, and this is so funny because I thought he was rich. Like the food at that table.
Yeah.
Living out in the country. Well, chicken and dumplings and peach cobbler though.
And
it's a very country food.
So much.
And buttermilk.
He doesn't have servants.
What's the buttermilk they're drinking?
Well, you're right. He eats well. So that's just interesting. Two very different responses to the same situation because in the book.
He doesn't live in Mexico.
Yeah.
So here's the thing though. Like, The thing that in great books leaves us not knowing how to respond to a character like this is they can say things that are both true and also problematic.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, you know, in one paragraph after he prays, and it's he prays with particular reference to Russia and the Jews and cannibalism, and he asks it all in Christ's name, amen, and raised up and reached for the cornbread. Then it says, people always want to know how I got started. He said, well, it was no mystery to me. When I first heard a radio, I knew what it was for, and it wasn't no questions about it neither. My mother's brother built a crystal set, bought through the mail. it'd come in a box and you put it together. We lived in South Georgia and we'd heard about the radio, of course, but we never had actually seen one play with our own eyes. It's a world of difference. Well, I knew what it was for, because there couldn't be no more excuses, you see. A man might harden his heart to where he could no longer hear the word of God, but you turn the radio up real loud, well, hardness of heart won't do it no more. He's got to be deaf as a post. Besides, there's a purpose for everything in this world, you see. Sometimes it might be hard to see what it is, but the radio? Well, my, my. You can't make it no plainer than that. The radio was in my plans from the start. It's what brought me to the ministry. And then there's the bit right after that where he says, well, when he was done, he wiped his mouth and pushed back his chair. Well, he said, y'all excuse me. I got to go work. The Lord don't take no holidays. So I find this fascinating because on the one hand...
And then he goes to sleep.
Right. On the one hand, and then his wife brags about him. So a lot of the stuff is his wife bragging about him. But on the one hand, there couldn't be no more excuses. See, a man might harden his heart, but the radio can help us get away from that. There is a little bit of truth to that. But then he starts talking about how the radio was in his plans. And then when it says, I got to go to work and the Lord don't take no holidays, there's a clear structural connection between the Lord and himself thematically. So he does see himself as being, you know, this prophetic figure. And his wife sees him in that way as well.
Yes.
But what does that mean about how, what the book is saying about the other things that he says?
Yes.
And that's what makes it complicated. Because he can say things that are true, but be a problem himself. And that's why I think we have a hard time with it, and we can read it in different
ways. Agreed. And I mean, either way, he is insufficient to the suffering that is presented by Cormac McCarthy in this novel. Mm-hmm. He has no meaningful solutions. Mm-hmm. It's very clear that he lives in a tiny little protected world of luxury in which he's well nourished on how he has on his life's work. And that meanwhile, the world is shrouded in darkness. And even this boy at his table is in a state of profound trauma, and he doesn't, and all he does is talk about himself.
Yes.
So whether he has a good heart or whether he is a, you know, just praying, using religion as a way to enrich himself, either way, it's insufficient to the darkness of the world. And I think that's why Christians often don't like Cormac McCarthy or level accusations of nihilism toward him, because it's in every single one of his novels, religion doesn't help. So, and Sunset Limited is the best example of that. However,
that's so funny. I read that so differently. Also, I read that so differently.
I don't know how. And this one, I'll say to him, I do not know how you could possibly read that differently. Truly,
I think. I mean, like, we're about to get into a book that nobody has read, or a play that nobody's read. I think it's point counterpoint. I don't know. There's like a solution.
Well, I don't. I will say I haven't read. I haven't read it. I've only seen it performed by Samuel L. Jackson and Tommy Lee Jones. And it was absolutely, Tommy Lee Jones won that with honors in that production. Mm. He sails away with that argument and he plays the nihilist. So this is, but I don't know if that was just the production, and maybe not in the written work. I haven't actually read it. But the point I'm making stands, which is, in no Cormac McCarthy novel does Christianity offer a meaningful solution to the darkness in the world. And that's why Christians often think of it as nihilistic. And I don't think it is. I think Cormac McCarthy is groping around trying to find the light. And the best he can come up with is that there's these pools of light and you wander in darkness in between them. But he does not see God as an answer to life's suffering, or at least he doesn't see American Christianity at the very least.
I think that's
least.
A real big distinction. Yeah, I think that's a real big distinction.
But he doesn't leave the door open for another form of Christianity to meet that.
I wonder what that would look like.
Yeah, right. But this is what, you know, I'm saying. I don't think you can make any kind of case that Cormac McCarthy is an advocate for the faith. But I don't think he's a nihilist. I think he believes in human goodness, for sure.
But I think, see, I think to me, the problem is it's that line about a man might harden his heart to where he can no longer hear the word of God. And the problem is that even the minister with the radio isn't actually helping.
Right.
Like when someone has hardened their heart to the word of God, you can shout at them and you can play the radio as loud as you possibly can. And that's not going to cause them. It's not going to soften their hard hearts. And what makes someone harden their heart and then step away from that hardness and become softer is a mystery. And that I think is what
totally
is
agree.
The light and the darkness, those moments of light, those moments of darkness are so tied to the question of whether someone has hardened their heart to God, to the word of God, and whether someone has is soft enough to hear. And I think that what we get with John Grady Cole is someone navigating that who ultimately, I believe, has not hardened his heart to the word of God. And like I'm using that the phrase word of God because Cormac McCarthy is using that.
Agreed.
I'm not saying that he is making like a polemical Christian novel, but I think that the idea of hardening your heart to the word of God is crucial to all of Cormac McCarthy's work. And if you read Blood Meridian, it's especially crucial.
I totally agree with everything you're saying.
Evil comes out of hardening one's heart. It is because the hardening of heart is a virus. It's a parasite. I think he's making a connection between those two things. There's like an early church concept of sin as an illness going on in Cormac McCarthy, which I'm kind of obsessed with in books. So maybe that's one of the reasons why I like this. I'm just now realizing that. And I think that even the minister here, he has hardened his heart to what is the true word of God, even as he, you know, probably has done some good. I don't think McCarthy is saying this guy hasn't done some good. I think that he's just saying this guy has.
It's weak. Yeah. Yeah.
He has allowed himself to, you know, be obsessed with his own clippings. Not hair
David,
clippings.
I agree so strongly with what you said. When I read Cormac McCarthy, I read him as sort of reminding the readers of what the kind of primeval wound is that we're dealing with. And I think the thing that he finds at best unsatisfying or at worst repugnant is the application of the balm without actually treating what the primeval wound is. And that's how I read Jimmy Blevins. And that's how I read some of his more
cynical.
That's how, yeah, I wish there was another word because I don't find that cynical.
Well, to me, it's a cynical. That's true. Yeah. I see what you're saying. Yeah. Cynical expression by McCarthy, I guess is what I mean.
Maybe so. But to me, going back to the kind of like the original.
You find it true.
Question. I find it true. Yeah. I find it true. And to be reminded of how profound the stakes are. To how deep the wound is. I walk away from this book and I'm reminded. And I also am reminded and encouraged that John Grady Cole may not be able to explain what exactly is going on in theological terms, but not only does he understand the wound, I also think that he is determined to not let that wound become a cancer that eats him. And he has seen example after example of example in this book of people who have let that wound completely infiltrate their lives and overwhelm them. But he won't do that. And if McCarthy doesn't talk about, whatever we're going to call it, big top American Christianity, if he doesn't recommend that as a solution, again, I find that true. That's truth telling.
Agreed.
I mean, clearly I have no sympathies with big top Christianity. So that's the kind of like conviction, the kind of bias.
So then for you, though, it works. That's one of the reasons why you like the book, because it speaks to a way of looking at the world that is, I was going to say consistent with yours, but that's appealing or that jives with your way of looking at the world.
Yeah.
So you were going to say something, but we should start thinking about wrapping this up because we've been going for a long time.
No, I actually wasn't. I was just going to say I agree with everything Tim said.
So then if By the way, side note from earlier, that light from going from light to light thing. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite things about McCarthy is the way these little things come back later. And I'm going to claim that I think he did this on purpose. When he gets to the judge's house, he makes a point to tell us that there's a light on in the window. When he gets to Rollins' house, he makes a point to tell us there's a light on in the window. And wow. I think that those are...
David, you have a really good eye for those, for like precise imagery. You always see things that I never see, and then you bring them up, and I'm like, oh yeah, how did I miss that?
Most of the time, I think I'm probably just seeing something that... Here's the thing. If I am making that up and he didn't mean it that way, I don't think that makes me wrong.
Because at least it creates an atmosphere.
Because I think that sometimes writers also do things, though. There's an atmosphere, but I think there's also a sense that writers do things subconsciously that, like, when you're so engrossed, so connected to your story and to what you're trying to say, I think that authors sometimes things happen. There's a consistency in a work because there's a consistency in an author's soul that they can't always name. And so even if he was like, oh yeah, I didn't notice that, I still think my argument still holds.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we got to talk about the ending, because if it's true, we've got a character, one of you said this, I can't remember which one. We've got a character who's trying to navigate this world. I think he is a character who has not hardened himself, which is why he doesn't kill, to your point earlier, Tim. That's why he doesn't kill the guy. Mm-hmm. He has not hardened himself to the phrase that used to the word of God, to use that phrase again. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the book, where does he stand? On page 301, he's at the funeral for what's her name? The woman who had worked for the family. And
what is her name? It's not Anna, is it?
Well, I don't remember what her name was, but she's at the funeral. Yeah. And it says, he turned and put on his hat and turned his wet face to the wind. And for a moment, he held out his hands as if to steady himself, or as if to bless the ground there, or perhaps as if to slow the world that was rushing away and seemed to care nothing for the old or the young, or the rich or the poor, or dark or pale, or he or she, nothing for their struggles, nothing for their names, nothing for the living or the dead. We have this image here of the funeral, the world spins on. And the fact that the world is going to go on despite all that's happened to him, despite the people around him dying, that feels harsh. This seems to be a harshness to that. And yet the world spins on. And then we get a break. And it says in 4 days riding, he crosses the Pecos. And we get to the end of the book, two last paragraphs. And I feel like we need to at least discuss what's going on in these last paragraphs.
Wait, you want to read those paragraphs, David?
Sure. It's 301 and 302. In 4 days riding, he crossed the Pecos at Iran, Texas, and rode up out of the river breaks where the pump jacks and the Yates field ranged against the skyline, rose and dipped like mechanical birds. Like great primitive birds welded up out of iron by hearsay in a land perhaps where such birds once had been. At that time, there were still Indians camped on the western plains, and late in the day he passed in his riding a scattered group of their wickiups propped upon that scoured and trembling waste. They were perhaps a quarter mile to the north, just huts made from poles and brush with a few goat hides draped across them. The Indians stood watching him. He could see that none of them spoke among themselves or commented on his riding there, nor did they raise a hand in greeting or call out to him. They had no curiosity about him at all, as if they knew all that they needed to know. They stood and watched him pass and watched him vanish upon that landscape solely because he was passing. Solely because he would vanish. The desert he rode was red, and red the dust he raised, the small dust that powdered the legs of the horse he rode, the horse he led. In the evening, a wind came up and reddened all the sky before him. There were a few cattle in that country, because it was barren country indeed, yet he came at evening upon a solitary bull rolling in the dust against the blood-red sunset like an animal in sacrificial torment. The blood-red dust blew down out of the sun. He touched the horse with his heels and rode on. He rode with the sun coppering his face and the red wind blowing out of the west across the evening land and the small desert birds flew chittering among the dry bracken, and horse and rider and horse passed on, and their long shadows passed in tandem, like the shadow of a single being, passed and paled into the darkening land, the world to come.
Cormac.
So I want to read the first couple sentences of the book again. The candle flame and the image of the candle flame caught in the pyroglass twisted and righted when he entered the hall and again when he shut the door. So he's at this funeral. It's when he sees his grandfather in the... So it's at the beginning, it's the grandfather at the funeral. And the candle flame and the image of the candle flame caught in the pyroglass twisted and righted when he entered the door. Again, the hall, and again when he shut the door. And at the end, he's just left the funeral of this woman who took care of them. And it says that the shadows of the horses pass in tandem like the shadow of a single being, passed and paled into the darkening land. And that suggests to me the notion of flickering. So we have this idea of, you know, flickering candles, flickering lights, shadows, all these things. I mean, it even says in the first line, the candle flame and the image of the candle flame. So there's this idea of shadows in both cases, at the beginning, the first line and the last line, first sentence, last sentence. I guess it's not literally the last line. How do you read these last paragraphs, this recurring image, given everything else that we've talked about in this book?
Well, and on page 5, we have an almost identical sentence to the last paragraph of the novel. He rode with the sun coppering his face and the red wind blowing out of the west. He turned south along the old war trail and he rode out to the crest of a low rise, dismounted and dropped. So we do have similar language. It's obviously a recall. The end is a recall of the beginning, right? We are intended to think of him as coming back, arriving at the end, and it is similar to the beginning, right? It has this kind of trajectory, a circular form, and which goes back to the question that you brought up earlier, which is how has he changed throughout the novel when he arrives at kind of this new... At the beginning of the novel, he's 16. He's orphaned here by his grandfather, and he's left out of his land. His mother has abandoned him. His father doesn't have the resources to parent him and to be a present father in his life. And so he sets out on this journey south, and all of these things happen to him. And at the end of the novel, he arrives back where he began, kind of, and yet through, he's gone through yet another orphanhood, right? And he is now solitary. He's gone from boy to man, and he's arrived at the beginning and knows himself now in a new way, and perhaps has gained resources for now his more solitary journey that he's about to go on again.
I'm so glad you mentioned page 5 because I marked up, I hadn't thought of this until you just started reading that, because, whoa, okay. So he's talking about all these directions that he goes in page 5. Mm-hmm. And in the end, he turns south along the old war trail, and it even talks about the wind. So in the evening, he saddled his horse and rode out west from the house. This is on page 5. The wind was much abated and it was very cold, and the sun sat blood red and elliptic under the reefs of blood red cloud. He rode where he would always choose to ride, out where I love that. Like, he always went this direction, right? But then at the end of the section, he goes south. So he rode where he would always choose to ride, out where the western fork of the old Comanche road, coming down out of the Kiowa country to the north, passed through the westernmost section of the ranch. And you can see the faint trace of it bearing south over the low prairie that lay between the north and middle forks of the river. The ancient road was shaped before him in the rose and canted light, like a dream of the past. And then where the painted ponies and the riders of that lost nation came out of the north with their faces chalked and their long hair plaited. When the wind was in the north, you could hear them, the horses and the breath of the horses and the hooves. And he goes on about, remember that image of the young boys naked and the on the wild horses and all this like ancient Indian imagery. And at the end here, it has the Indians watching him go. They're just sitting there watching him silently. I thought about the image of the candle-like image, the flickering light image, but I didn't remember going back quite that far.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he has the thesis of, I don't want to say thesis, that's too strong of a word. He has yet another reference on page 5 to the conclusion that our La Dueña comes to in the section we talked about last week, when he says in the middle of the paragraph, the long paragraph on page 5, he says, hold on, let me find, it's in the really long sentence. Let me find a place where I can begin it. He's describing the Indians going south, each armed for war, which was their life, and the women and children and women with children at their breasts, all of them pledged in blood and redeemable in blood only. And we have this blood-soaked landscape. Everything's red, blood red. The dust is blood red. The wind is red. The sunset is red, all of it. And then you have the people who must pay for their lives with their own blood. And that is that's the entire kind of arc of the novel is bookended, I guess, by these images. Blood soaked landscape and a man alone, a solitary man going south.
But then at the end, it doesn't tell us which direction he leaves, which I love, because it's at the beginning of the book, we talked about how he was always going to go to Mexico, and he turned south along the old war trail, and how little did he know that that was what was actually going to happen. But then at the end of the book, it doesn't say which direction he goes. And I love that the stasis of that. It said he rides off and he's riding the way he always went before, but it never tells us which way he turns. So we don't really, you know. Presumably he goes north or anywhere but back where he came
from. He's going, right?
But I love the way McCarthy offers that bit of stasis. But the bull, Tim, explain the bull.
I mean, I don't know. It's such a stark vision, right? I mean, it's just, you can see it almost like an icon.
It's the sacrifice. It's the blood sacrifice.
Yeah.
Of, go on.
Well, certainly Old Testament. It's like, there's a,
like everything has Zeus to be paid effect. For in blood. I said earlier that that's a thesis statement. And then I said, that's too strong. Maybe it's not. I think that that is part of this novel, that everything is paid for in blood and you might not get to keep it even if you pay for it, but you can still move from pools of light to pools of light. The world is the world is a violent place that requires a sacrifice. And we all have to pay for what we can't just take what we want. We have to pay for it somehow. And there's that idea of the blood sacrifice, that is required of us in our human journey. And as La Dueña claims, the Mexicans are just more honest about it. Right.
Yeah. I think that takes us back to questions of justice too. Like, right. And the idea that every decision you make is going to lead to something. Mm-hmm. Like there is a consequence for every, whether you turn south, north, east, or west. I did this with my fingers and I was like pointing as I was saying south, north, east, and west, and did like not one of the times that I actually point a direction what I was saying.
Right.
Whether you turn south, north, east, or west, the adventure that you take is going to have a consequence based on that turning.
Right. And again, the question of, with every Cormac McCarthy novel I've ever read, which you guys have read more than I have, but the idea of following that moral compass will cost you everything. It will cost you your desire, the desire of your heart. You will lose it. Will it still be worth it? And I think he always seems to answer the question with, yes, it was worth it. Like, you don't get to the end of this novel and think John Grady Cole sure screwed that up, right? Like, you're like, he did everything he had to do. He did the right thing every time. And when he made a mistake, he paid for it. Yeah. And so it's very satisfying, and it has this sense of justice to it, internal justice and cohesion to it. And like Cormac McCarthy set the terms, and he created at the center, a, a hero who more than rose to the occasion, but he still paid for it. He still suffered very greatly. And yet we're left being thinking, I want to be like that guy. Mm-hmm. Right? And so I think to your point, Tim, there is this internal truth to it that's so compelling, but it's still a bit mysterious to try to tease it out.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
We should wrap this up. It's been a very long episode. Tim, unless Heidi fights you for it, I'm going to give you the last word here.
Last word belongs to you.
You've read it the most, and it's absolutely one of your hard books.
I'm afraid that anything I say will be a trite attempt to kind of summarize all of my feelings about this book, and I would fail at that. My last word would be, keep reading. I think that the remaining two books of the Border Trilogy they're excellent. They're different than this mm-hmm. book. But I think the themes that were articulated in this book are articulated in the next two books in ways that, oh man, they're just incredible. The Crossing is such a beautiful book. And it's bewildering in a way that this book for me is not. There's all sorts of questions at the end of All the Pretty Horses. Mm-hmm. But I think the questions are even bigger at the end of The Crossing. And I do think there's more. I think that the conclusion of the trilogy, for me, it's I'm going to warn you, it ain't an up ending, but it's a very satisfying ending. And I think a lot of the spiritual questions, and I don't want to say religious for the reasons that we've talked about on this podcast, but some of the spiritual questions that are raised in this book, I think they are addressed by the second and third book.
I think these are books that are going to, I genuinely believe in 200 years, these are books that people will still read.
Absolutely.
I came to the conclusion that this book is for late 20th century American lit, what Brideshead Revisited was for its era. That's a different.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's a thesis that I refuse to defend. Undefended.
It would be a fun one for you to defend. That'd be a fun one for you to defend.
We don't have time for that though. This is fun.
This is really fun.
Cormac McCarthy gets us recording hour and 40 minute episodes.
Thanks for including me, guys. This is so great.
Yeah, was it bearable?
We could have it no other way, Heidi.
Are you kidding? I loved it. I can't wait to do another book like this.
Our next book is going to be Zora Neale Hurston's That Eyes Were Watching God. So we'll do the Q&A next week. And then I guess that takes us to the last week of July will be our first foray into that book. So we'll do the first couple chapters. I think it's 50 pages or roughly 50 pages. We'll post the schedule again. I think it should be up on the Facebook group and on the newsletter page, but we'll post it again. So yeah, a couple weeks to get started on that while we do the Q&A next week. And again, you can send questions to david@goldberrybooks.com or you can post it on your question on the thread on Facebook. Hey, Heidi, you want to be in charge of posting that thread?
I really do. I can't wait.
thank you for saving me.
Yes.
From forgetting that. All right. Well, this was a great time. Tim, do you want to add anything else? Just I want to give you a chance.
No, I'm great.
Okay. Heidi, anything?
No, I'm good.
All right. Well, for Heidi White and for Tim McIntosh, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, happy reading.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.